Later on in the program, we're going to be hearing from Creative Santa Fe. I'd like now to welcome back to the show Tim McLaughlin. He is the director of the Santa Fe Indian School Spoken Word Program. He is a poet, and his new book is called Walking on Earth, Touching the Sky, Poetry and Prose by Lakota Youth at Red Cloud Indian School. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always great to be here.
Now, this is a project that you did some years ago with these Lakota kids.
That's right. This is from my first teaching experience when I was just 22 years old, and I was on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota for 3 years, and I was teaching middle school students. And so my first time teaching creative writing and asking students to write and express themselves, and just very powerful experience with those young people and with their words, and I had a lot of faith that someday there would be a possibility of publishing this work, and now that dream is coming to fruition.
So this is the work of the young people whom you taught.
That's right, yes.
Now, when you hear about Pine Ridge, you hear about economic depression, violence, alcoholism, and
disease, despair,
travesties of law enforcement against people, and so on.
Yes.
You look at this book, and maybe it's there underneath, but there's so much love and spirit that you seem to have pulled out of these young people.
Right. And I think, you know, the media portrayals of the Lakota people and of Pine Ridge Reservation just sort of scratch the surface of the reality there. You know, all those things that you talked about are there on the surface, and the hard realities of life are very much present. And they also contribute to the students' abilities to say things that are real and meaningful, because many of them have suffered some of these hard realities. But what you don't hear about in the media is the balancing agent, that the young people grow up in this profound system of cultural ways, and that they have a deep connection with the land, and that the land is not scarred with the arms of capitalism. It's basically untouched, you know, and that they have a sense of community that I haven't experienced at the same level anywhere else in our country or throughout the world, and they have humor and stories and art and all these things running through their lives in deep ways, amidst and despite the poverty.
One of the realities of so many Indian people is the legacy of the Indian boarding schools, which was basically designed to remove their culture, remove their language, and mainstream them into white American, Anglo-American society. And that's part of the story in Pine Ridge also.
It is. And that's part of the story of this school, Red Cloud Indian School, was originally established in the late 1800s, actually at the request of Chief Red Cloud. You know, he sort of saw that the writing was on the wall, and that traditional life was not going to exist forever and ever and, you know, completely intact, and that his children, so to speak, the Lakota children, would need to learn about other things and be educated, so to speak, in different ways. And so he specifically wanted the Jesuits to come and be the ones who did that educating, as opposed to other religious groups or other you know, possibilities in terms of who would work with the Lakota children.
Why the Jesuits?
He knew that their standard of education was so very high, and he just sort of had an affinity for them and trusted them. And I think through a lot of prayer and reflection and talking to the spirits, he felt that was the choice he needed to make. And he was criticized by many Lakota people for making that choice, but I think the wisdom of it is bearing out now. And that school certainly is, its history is checkered with dark and light pages. It was very much part of the federal government's goal to assimilate and acculturate, and there are a lot of travesties that occurred at that school. But I think at this point, the school has done a 180 in some sense, and the mission is redirected. And it used to just be called Holy Rosary Mission. Now they've adopted that name, Red Cloud Indian School, and it's considered a Lakota Catholic school. And they're celebrating and encouraging native language and culture. Lakota language and culture are an integral part of the overall curriculum, and the school is integrated into the pulse of the community, and it's a beautiful thing, just like the Santa Fe Indian School here in our town, where I now work.
It seems to me, and this is maybe a very cynical way of looking at it, but that the resurgence of language and culture only seem to happen when the political power of that group has been completely destroyed.
Right. We start to get desperate.
Well, I mean, the Indian vote doesn't really count for all that much in the United States right now. The territory is pretty much gone. The power, namely dominating this entire continent that they once had, was destroyed. And once that destruction, really the last nail was on the coffin, yeah, now you have your language and your culture and your ways. Go for it. Have fun.
Right. It's, yeah, it's sort of like, how do we pick up the pieces at this point? And it, you know, it's a desperate reality in some ways, but I think that the people are really celebrating this resurgence, and amazingly, and I think we all need to learn from this, they don't seem to, as a general rule, harbor bitterness or anger or hold on to anything, that there's an ability to be in the present moment and to realize that this moment has all the opportunities that any other moment did in history, and that the babies that are being born right now and the ones that are coming deserve every opportunity to know their culture fully and their language, and to think that nothing is lacking, you know, in this moment.
So in what ways do you see that Lakota culture did survive? Did the language survive, for example?
The language is alive. You know, certainly it's in trouble in some respects, that mostly it's the elders who speak it fluently. And the young people, you know, for instance, that I taught at the Red Cloud Indian School, most of them were not fluent, per se. The way that the elders explain it is that everything hinges on the language, you know, because when you take the ceremonies and begin to conduct them in English or in a different way, they really change the fabric of how things happen, how you perceive the world, how you understand things. The Lakota language is beautiful. It's been explained to me that, you know, I know very little of it, but that when you're speaking it, both sides of your brain are engaged, and it's very much picture-based, and it's very much circular and multidimensional, and very much like poetry. And I think that's what's beautiful, and I think that's why Native people really respond to poetry when they're, you know, when they're working in English and in the educational world and in schools, and then they are able to experience poetry, and it feels like prayer or like their ceremonies or their culture, that there's a lot more magic to this. It's not so linear and logical and two-dimensional. It can contradict and include and spin in beautiful ways and be incantatory and all these sort of things that are incredible.
I know you don't really speak the language, but have you witnessed that and sort of felt it in some way in that context of ceremonies or whatever?
Yes, I was invited into the culture, and I think that's the only way I could, you know, present a book like this, is that having lived for that small time of 3 years, and then coming back every summer to the reservation as my spiritual home, that I began to understand the worldview on a much deeper level by beginning to be immersed in the culture. I learned some songs and practiced the Lakota ways alongside my own Catholic upbringing. And it became something that I felt I was looking for in my own life. An interesting sort of side story, but really it's the core story for me, is that my great-grandmother was born on an Indian reservation because her mother, my great-great-grandmother, made a decision in the late 1800s to go teach on a reservation in Washington State. And so her child, one of her children, my great-grandmother, was born there and grew up with Native people until she was 13, living that indigenous lifestyle with the Native peoples. And she's someone I knew as a boy, and she influenced me powerfully. And I believe, in retrospect, that she bequeathed this spiritual inheritance to me, that I would have this affinity for and this connection to Native peoples and this longing to do something different. I grew up on the East Coast in Washington, D.C., and didn't even know any Native American people, and yet I felt this sacred longing that something else was going to happen with my life. And when I came west, I figured out what that something was.
Very interesting. And you ended up having been raised Catholic in this school that had Catholic roots.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
So how did you work with the people, with the young people? I mean, here you are, 22-year-old kid with spiritual longings and
right,
trying to get a degree or whatever. You go in to the school, and you meet these kids with from very different cultural backgrounds. You are a poet. Did you start with poetry?
You know, I was actually assigned to be a librarian, middle school librarian. And I think I spent 1 week working with the young people and teaching them everything that I could think was interesting about library science. And not to say that it's not a beautiful discipline, it's just that's about as much as I had to say or work with them in that regard. And so I went to my administrator, and I credit her so much, Linda Johnson, and I said to her, can I teach creative writing? That's my real love. And at that time, I wrote a lot of short stories and some poetry. And she said, go for it. Do it. You know, if that's what you're passionate about, then try it. And so I didn't go to college to be a teacher, per se. I was an English major and a French major. So in terms of teaching, I was definitely blind and just sort of finding my way. But I did have a lot of experience working with young people, and I thought that I was very good at that. Although on my first day teaching on the reservation, I fell flat on my face. You know, I had worked with inner city kids in D.C. I thought all sorts of kids, and then I could do this. But I was being pretty much plainly refused by those kids, and they were waiting to see what I was made of, really. And I think, especially in the realm, the personal realm of creative writing, they were not going to share their stories until they saw that my heart was good, which is a very Lakota way of looking at things, that my heart was good, and that I was strong enough to bear these stories, you know, and honor them, I think, in the way that I have.
And so what did that process look like? Like, how long did it take?
That trust-building process.
Yeah.
Well, you know, by the second day that they started writing, you know, but in terms of getting to a point where the things really started to become meaningful, it was slow. And I had to just stay in there. You know, and in general, things are slower on the reservation. I mean, everywhere in rural America, but particularly there, people take their time. And when you take a step, you usually don't backpedal, you know, and that's true of the relationships, too, that they weren't going to move forward towards me as a teacher or as a friend or a confidant or anything like that until they were sure that first step could be taken, then the second and the third. And so I began to understand that's what was happening, you know, and that I needed to really have faith and not worry and trust that things were going to be okay. And then when the writing started coming in and being, you know, more than just silly expressions or here I'm done, that they were starting to speak their truth and want to express, that's when I started to become fueled and inspired and energized.
We're talking to Tim McLaughlin about his book, Walking on Earth, Touching the Sky, Poetry and Prose by Lakota Youth at Red Cloud Indian School. We've had you on before with some of your students at the Santa Fe Indian School talking about the poetry team, which has traveled internationally, gone to Washington, D.C., put on amazing performances at the Lensic that bring tears to your eyes, no matter who you are. Amazing, powerful people. And one of the things that was so striking about that was that there were a lot of people who didn't really acknowledge or think about or express their family stories, their native roots, their sense of community and context until they started doing poetry. Mm-hmm. And that is transformative. Did you see that happening on Pine Ridge at the Red Cloud Indian School?
In terms of diving into their stories,
yeah,
and whatnot? You know, I think maybe not in this to the same depth that it happened at the Santa Fe Indian School, partially because I was working with a different age group at that time. I was working with middle school students, and also I was just happy that they were writing at all. And I, you know, a lot of these poems in this book are, I mean, they're incredible in many ways as I look at them through the poet eyes, but they're raw and I didn't edit them a lot. And I was just learning how to teach, you know, but I think, you know, what happened at the Santa Fe Indian School could not have happened if I didn't have these experiences at Red Cloud Indian School. And a lot of people don't know about that I was learning how to teach, learning
right,
how to get young people to express in an honest way. And then when I came here, it became, what about bringing all of this material, once they create it, back into their bodies, into their air, back into a new sort of evolution of the oral tradition, for these kids to be dynamic storytellers through Native culture and modern culture and all these sorts of things. So I would say that, you know, the common element is that I've found among Native youth that I've taught that their writing is incredibly honest and genuine, and it just has some magic to it. They have a natural ability to put words together in creative ways that work. And like I said, when I look at this book now, and I just see some of the things that are happening with sound and with structure and repetition and the way the pieces just sort of came together and created something that's real, I'm amazed that 10 and 11 year olds did this many times on first draft basis.
Yeah.
So,
would you like to read some of the poems to us?
Yes, I think there are two poems in particular I'd like to share, and I think both of them, in a way, articulate the Lakota philosophy of Matakwe o Yasin, and that's the sort of the cornerstone of Lakota thought and cosmology. And Mitakuye means relative, and Oyasin is best translated, I think, as forever and ever. So you say related forever and ever, or we are all related, all things are related. And I don't know if that does justice to the concept. I think a picture is better. And if you think of the proverbial ripples in a pond when a stone is tossed in, that you have a small circle and then a next circle and a next circle, that all things, if that smallest circle is like the tiniest atom and the largest circle is the universe, if you will, that all things are nested together, and that not only are they all related like a family, but they all are each other. They actually are each other, that I am Mary Charlotte, and I am also the universe, and I am also the tiniest pebble, because we're all nested in this whole. We're all whole and part of larger wholes, and it's a beautiful philosophy that it's never explained in that intellectual way to the young people, but they grow up living that way, that all things are related, particularly our connection to what they call Unchimaka, Grandmother Earth, that you treat the earth as your grandmother with a lot of love, a lot of care, and a lot of reverence. You know, and not the sort of like, we're in control of the environment and, you know, this, that, the other thing. But to listen to what the earth is telling you, or what the animals are telling you, or what's coming through, like you would for your grandmother.
And it's such a contrast to the mechanistic way of, and analytical way of looking at the earth that many of us did grow up with here.
Yes, I mean, almost like a commodity or you know, just sort of this abstraction. As opposed to walking on the ground and thinking that you're touching the skin of your grandmother and you're massaging her back. And, you know, those kinds of concepts are just basic to Lakota youth and probably Native youth of all tribes.
And even to this day.
To this day.
Very interesting.
Yes, very much so. You know, we need to go beyond. Now we're all embracing this term, Mother Earth, but do we really feel it? You know, do we really feel that this is our mother or this is our grandmother that we're in communion with, that we're supposed to be in harmony with?
And what's the practice of doing that, of feeling that?
Mm-hmm.
Is it walking every day and thinking about it? What is it, prayer? I mean,
it's all of that, I think. You know, it's everything that you do. It's even just realizing that I'm being fed every moment by the air, and that's coming from the earth, you know, from the trees, from the creator, all that sort of thing, that I'm never separate. So the first piece is called All My Relatives, and it's by Kathy McLaughlin, coincidentally same last name as me. That name exists up there in South Dakota.
Yeah.
I think because of a famous or maybe infamous Indian agent who was up there. She says, all of my relatives are like the wild prairies, different sizes that are old and new. We are like the stars. There are a great many of us. We are like the seas. We have many voices. We are like the skies, always changing from beautiful to ugly and mean. Some of us are like the trees, very old and wise. The rest of us are like the flowers, still young and learning. And the second piece...
out of the mouths of babes.
Out of the mouths of babes. Everything you need is right there.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, so she gives, you know, I think, flesh to that concept of everything is related.
Yeah.
And the second one is by Anna Diaz, and it's called Vision of God. And when I asked the kids, the young people, to express how they saw the Creator or the Great Spirit or the Supreme Being, if you will, and a lot of them, interestingly, did not give human form to that, where I think in a lot of certainly Christian-based cultures, you would start to see a face and a person and long white beard or something. But she says, my vision of God is a spirit moving with us through every step we take along our path of life. He is in every living thing, in a tree, helping it move its leaves, in a rock, helping it live. He is in us, helping us paint all the colors of the world. He lives in us as we cross the beating sunset. He is with us through the coming moon. He is there when we hear the rivers roar. The Great Spirit is there when love and hate are in the painting winds. Vision of God.
We're talking to Tim McLaughlin about his book, Walking on Earth, Touching the Sky. So this is poetry and prose by young people who wrote these works, what, 10 years ago or more?
More than 10, 12 to 15 years ago.
So yeah. These people are all adults now. They're all in their 20s.
That's right. Yeah, and finding them is quite a task.
Were you able to find everybody who's in this book?
I was. I was able to find everybody, and they're almost universally all excited and really appreciative, and they remembered that I had said that I'd hoped this would happen at some point. You know, I was only 23 or 24 when I left the reservation. But I had that, you know, that notion that this could become a book. And I asked the kids, if you know, how do you feel about this? And we were able to talk about it even at that time many years ago. So it's been a beautiful reconnection with many of them, and it's something that I think is important to present the perspectives of the people, the Lakota people, through art, you know, and through, as you said, the youth and how they see things and how they express things.
How have they responded to the book? Have they gotten it in their hands yet?
Yeah, they just recently received it, many of them, and I'm hearing about it on Facebook, of course.
Right.
I think they love it. They're all just excited and happy and joy-filled and tearful and really moved by it. And, of course, we had this great partnership with S.D. Nelson, who's a Lakota artist.
That's what I was going to ask you about, the art in the book, which is great.
The book is published by Abrams Books in New York, and he's done several books with them already. And so Abrams actually approached him and asked if he would like to partner with me on this project, and he agreed to do so. And it's just the artwork is absolutely perfect, the absolute perfect complement to the content of the words.
And a very well-designed book, too.
And it's brilliantly designed. Abrams is just, they are masters at the aesthetics of what a book should look and feel like. And that's something I think we really need to continue to pursue in our society, you know, to have beautiful books. And I also invited Joseph Marshall, the author of The Lakota Way. He's a Lakota author and actor who lives here in Santa Fe, to write the foreword. And so that partnership with those two Lakota men is a very important part of the project, I believe.
Tim McLaughlin is a poet and writer. He is the director of the Santa Fe Indian School Spoken Word Program, and his new book that he edited is called Walking on Earth, Touching the Sky, Poetry and Prose by Lakota Youth at Red Cloud Indian School. And this coming Saturday, the 12th of May, he will be at Collected Works Bookstore at 4 in the afternoon, right on Galisteo Street on the corner of Water Street, doing a book signing, celebrating the release of this book, talking to people, and having a good time.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'll give a reading and then have a signing of the book and then celebrate.
It's a wonderful book, and I think it's also important maybe for people listening to this show who have young people in their life. It's a good gift, Christmas present, birthday present, whatever, just a gift for no reason whatsoever. Mm-hmm. for young people to see what their counterparts in a different part of the nation are doing and how they're thinking, and it's very inspirational.
Yes, I hope it will encourage young people of all backgrounds to pick up a pen or pencil and express what their truth is, you know, and really go through that creative process that I think is, you know, transformational, but really shaping, you know, and it gives you a chance to really experience life in a deep way, to create something new that's your truth.
Tim McLaughlin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Clark Hulse. He's executive director of Creative Santa Fe, and joining us by telephone is Eddie Friel, who is the president and CEO of EFA Tourism and City Marketing. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So Eddie is going to be the keynote speaker at an event which is this weekend at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 5 o'clock called Evolve or Die. Let's start with you, Clark. What is Creative Santa Fe about, and what is this Saturday event about?
Well, Creative Santa Fe is a nonprofit committed to strengthening the arts and culture economy here in Santa Fe. Evolve or Die kicks off our new initiative called Imagine Futures, where we're trying to bring big ideas and stimulate thinking about Santa Fe. Our feeling is that every city needs a dream, and it's time for us to start dreaming together and imagining Santa Fe's future.
So, Eddie, you are part of this, and Evolve or Die, it's an evolution metaphor. It's about animals facing ecosystems that they're not very well adapted for. What will you be talking about? You are somebody who has participated in really helping cities that were down and out turn themselves around.
Yes, I think the Evolve or Die theme is really a question of how we are currently struggling in the Western economies in the transition from what was a manufacturing economy to a creative, innovative knowledge economy. And that raises all kinds of challenges for places. And places have to be able to define what their competitive advantage now is in relation to other places when trying to attract either industry or workers or whatever, or tourists. But the idea of Creative Santa Fe really develops a great deal of energy around the United States. We are very, very interested in how Santa Fe particularly has developed the arts and creative industries in such a way as to be a beacon of light for those people who are trying to figure out what they should do in this transitional period. So if you take a place like Buffalo, which is probably described in American parlance as a Rust Belt city, it is in the business of trying to reinvent itself. It has gone through the transition of post-industrialization and all of the various difficulties that presents to a community. Then trying to restore that community, or trying to restore that city and give it back to its community as a place that they can identify with and be proud of again, is a really challenging exercise, and where a recent study has identified that the main drivers of the American economy is now going to be cities and city regions, we all have to redefine ourselves in terms of what that means. And the great urbanist Jane Jacobs said that the biggest thing that we have to sell is what is different. And I think that's the challenge that we face. But I think we will learn more from what Santa Fe does than what Santa Fe will learn from me. I think that's for sure.
Oh, very interesting. Because, I mean, I was looking at this whole thing and going, okay, Santa Fe is trying to remake itself as an art city? Are you kidding me, Clark?
Well, Santa Fe is, as Eddie says, a beacon of light among art cities. But there's an old saying that if we don't want anything to change, then we really do have a lot of work to get done. There are these massive changes in the world around us, and whether we are devising new art forms that Santa Fe is a part of or preserving what is best in Santa Fe, we really have to put our minds to it either way.
Let's talk about, just because, I mean, I'm so curious about it, you, Eddie Friel, get hired by cities, presumably the city council or the equivalent, to come into a city and, let's just take, for example, Glasgow, Scotland. What do you go into a city, what do you do? What do you observe, study, and then how do you act?
Well, I think the challenge of being Irish and suddenly being parachuted in somewhere, there has to be some kind of basic fundamental approach. And the approach is to try to get a baseline study or understanding of what are the drivers of the economy of that community, what are the strengths of the community in terms of the workforce and its skills, competencies, and education. What does the city have which is unique, and what is its history, heritage, and culture? And when you start to look at the industrial clusters that drive a particular city, then you begin to get a sense of, well, what is different? What can this place claim that no one else can claim, which is unique and which is of global significance? And then that becomes very, very interesting. So you arrive in the city of Glasgow, which was the shipbuilding capital of the world and which was once referred to as the second city of the empire. And you have this dreadful poverty and social deprivation as a consequence of losing all of its manufacturing base. And for some 45 years, the community was not given any hope whatsoever in terms of its future. And then suddenly, there was a bequest to the city of a museum, and the museum was the Burrell Collection, which was a private collection very similar to that of the Hearst Collection. And we built this museum, and within its first year, suddenly the world's media and art media and cultural media are coming to Glasgow, and everybody is asking, Glasgow? Surely they should be coming to Edinburgh. Why Glasgow? And this museum was really the foundation for reinventing Glasgow on the back of the cultural provision that the city already had, which was a consequence of successful business and businessmen reinvesting in their city, either in terms of architecture or performing arts or museums or design or whatever, but this reinvestment back in the community by successful entrepreneurs was part of the tradition of European cities, and Glasgow was one of those. So the challenge really was giving the people of Glasgow the confidence to be able to say that Glasgow was a city that really deserved your attention. But it needed some work, and it needed a platform to be able to create customers, because in tourism terms, 95% of all tourism was going to Edinburgh, and they didn't have a reason to come to Glasgow. So we had to try and create that reason so as to get attention in the marketplace. And we did that with the arts and cultural industries to challenge the perception of the city. Some people talk about arts and cultural tourism as if we were just simply creating art for tourists, which is absolutely not the case. The arts and the cultural industries have a vital part in our day-to-day existence in terms of who we are, what we are, and what we aspire to be. And it's not an optional extra. And our education system has to recognize the compelling necessity of the arts for every community. So we just simply had the opportunity to use the arts and cultural industries in Glasgow to attract attention once more in this city. And I bid for Glasgow to become the cultural capital of Europe. And we won that designation. Once we won that designation, we could no longer be considered an industrial slum. And that was the real challenge for us, to win the confidence of the European community that Glasgow was once more a major European city and return it to the world as a major international city again. That was our challenge. And every city right now, if I can tell you that today there are 147 new cities in China, which 5 years from now will have populations of over 8 million. The urbanization of China and India is the greatest challenge we face in the Western economy today. And we have to respond to those challenges, hence the theme of evolve or die. How do we evolve our American cities to make them great American cities again, like reclaiming Detroit, reclaiming Buffalo, reclaiming Pittsburgh, reclaiming those cities that we abandoned for whatever reason, because of decline. Mm-hmm. And we cannot do that to our communities.
Eddie's hit on some very important points there, if they're particularly around the question of education and the question of who we are as the residents of this city. If there's an issue about Santa Fe that I might raise, it's the perception that Santa Fe is an old city. Is it a city that's able to hold and attract a creative younger generation? So one of the things that we're most excited about in connection with the Evolve or Die program is that simultaneously we are looking at the question of affordable workspace for young artists and performers. This is a question that has been on many agendas in this city for a decade or more. We're bringing in an expert team from the biggest, most successful operator of affordable art spaces in the United States to assess the needs and the support, quite frankly, in this community for affordable space. In other words, where does a young artist, a young creative person, move to after they've finished school and as they're making the transition into the arts economy? We want to look very hard at this question, see what is possible, open up opportunities, open up the discussion, and move the issue forward.
Well, I mean, honestly, when I moved here, which was about 20 years ago, housing was cheap and creative people could move here, and there were all these creative people doing stuff and staying for a while, and some of them stayed and some of them left. But now so many wealthy retired people have bought up all the houses and driven up the price of real estate and the price of rent so much that none of those people are coming anymore, and I wouldn't either if I were them. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have come myself.
And this is the problem. People call it the problem of the missing middle. I'll be quite frank. I want to draw and hold creative young people to Santa Fe, but retired people are good too. We need people producing art. We need people buying art, people appreciating art, if we're to continue to be an artistic beacon. One of the things I want to make sure that people know is that we are having a public forum about affordable art space. It will be on Thursday at 5 o'clock at the Lannan Meeting House on Reed Street in Santa Fe. So I want to get the message out about not one but two events, the public meeting about affordable art space and then the public presentation on Saturday.
So back to Eddie Friel. We're talking to Eddie Friel of EFA Tourism and City Marketing, who will be the keynote speaker at this event, Evolve or Die, on Saturday, and Clark Hulse, who's the executive director of Creative Santa Fe. Glasgow, amazing transformation that you described. What about Buffalo, New York? What's been happening there? What are you doing there?
Well, I think Buffalo is a very, very interesting story because I was brought here by Niagara University with a grant from the O'Shea Foundation, who had carried out some research into the arts and cultural industries in Western New York and were particularly interested in this idea of cultural tourism. And I was invited to come to help implement a program following a research document that had been produced to suggest that the opportunity that cultural tourism presented to Buffalo was really quite attractive. However, when I arrived, I find a slightly different situation. First of all, the idea of the city of Buffalo being proud of itself and understanding what kind of city and heritage it had didn't come across. Instead, what I got was a lot of people almost apologizing for the place and lacking in self-confidence. And yet, in my first week, when I was driven around by the foundation director who brought me here, I was amazed at how beautiful a city Buffalo was in terms of its architecture and design and in terms of Olmsted Park layout, in terms of urban layout. This was a really beautiful city. And because for some 45 years it has been in decline and losing population dramatically, it had lost its self-confidence to such a degree that it added the name Niagara to Buffalo in order to give it some kind of legitimacy in the marketplace, which was an apologetic stance. And my response to that was, why are you apologizing for this phenomenal city that has this wonderful architecture? You've got the history of American architecture in stone in the city. You have a beautiful layout, and the provision of arts and cultural industries is utterly amazing, yet you're apologizing for the place. So getting back to this question about what is the absolute unique feature that your city has, which no one else can possibly claim, I looked at this architectural heritage and the design heritage, and I thought, this has to be brought together to give people confidence in this city so that they understand that they do have something which is very unique and very precious and very worthwhile. So we gradually started to articulate the case that Buffalo was a wonderful city, and you didn't have to tag on the name Niagara in order to legitimize it. You were 25 miles from Niagara Falls, so just be proud of the fact that you are a city. The other issue was that the unit of analysis of economic performance in the 21st century global economy today is the city region. In America, what we've done with a lot of our cities is we've torn the heart out of the center of the city and scattered it in urban sprawl out into the periphery. And our inner cities have become dead spaces where there is lifeless lack of energy, and we just simply need to reclaim the city core again, because no city region can compete effectively without a successful city at its core. So what we are engaged in right now is reclaiming the central core of the city of Buffalo, attracting industries, mostly health, education, tourism, and various arts and cultural industries, into the central core of the city again, and recognizing that without a successful city at its core, the region will fail.
How do you do that logistically, given that the land in the center of the city is presumably owned by somebody who may have their own ideas of what to do about it and things like that?
Well, you have a number of choices. When you're developing an economic development strategy, you have fundamentally got four things. You have land, you have capital, you have the skills and creativity of your people, and you have systems and processes. And those four things need to be aligned to deliver a strategy that everybody agrees upon. And to get everybody to agree upon that strategy, your baseline study has to identify what are the drivers of the economy in the future where you will have a competitive advantage over other places. Then how do you organize your infrastructure and your skills to be able to compete effectively? And that very rapidly is the issue that we face in Buffalo, and it's an issue we face in Niagara Falls. So the first thing you do is you create a land bank whereby the public sector buys whatever land is available, and you then begin to think, well, 10 years from now, who are our customers going to be? What kind of goods and services are they going to be looking for? And what kind of city can we build which is a livable, sustainable city for a 21st century knowledge economy rather than a 19th and 20th century manufacturing economy? Because we are changing. And cities are becoming more and more attractive places to live because the social strata and the way in which we go about things in today's society is different. And young people specifically, and young creative people, want to come back and live in city centers where everything is close at hand, where you do not need a motor car, and where you can share your talent and your experience and your creativity with people of like mind in a similar place. And these are the sorts of challenges that when you go into different cities, and every city is different. You cannot do a Glasgow and Buffalo, and you cannot do a Buffalo and Santa Fe. I mean, every place is unique because the community itself is unique. And ultimately, when you're trying to present a city to an external audience, to all intents and purposes, you represent the community's brand. And you have to be the champion for the people who own that community. And that's what you have to try to do. That can be very challenging because where I come from, I was born in Northern Ireland. And there are two different cultures in Northern Ireland, one British and one Irish, and you get this clash. And trying to get people to find, well, what do you feel ownership of? Which culture are you choosing? Whose culture is it anyway? And you get into these very, very interesting conversations where people need to learn to share space and to accept diversity and to really enjoy diversity, because that's what makes us really interesting places.
Well, there's much more to talk about along those lines, and a lot of this will be talked about at this event, which is this weekend at the New Mexico History Museum, called Evolve or Die. It's at 5 o'clock on Saturday. And Clark Hulse, this is a panel discussion.
It's a panel discussion. Eddie will kick us off with his broad and incisive perspective, but he will be joined by a very, very strong panel, Louis Grachos, who is the director of the Albright Knox Gallery in Buffalo, and was
an early director of Site Santa Fe.
Exactly. He's someone who knows both cities well. Mary Roberts, who's the director of the Darwin Martin House, a very important Frank Lloyd Wright house, and has been key and the leader in restoring that landmark. And then Matthew Meyer, who is a very exciting architect who has designed affordable art spaces in Buffalo, in New York City, and is currently working on one in El Paso. And they'll each bring a distinct perspective.
So that this is happening this weekend, and then there's also an event tomorrow, Thursday the 10th of May.
Right. That's a public forum about art space, about affordable workspace for artists. That's at 5 p.m. at the Lannan Meeting House at 315 Reed Street. And then on Saturday evening, also at 5 p.m., is the Evolve or Die panel discussion at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. I need to stress that there are very, very few tickets remaining there.
Ah, okay.
We're expecting a full house.
Excellent. Well, good. It's a lot of, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind, and we don't have time to go into it very deeply now, but maybe, Eddie, when you're here, you can address this, is the question of, okay, I mean, I've seen this in different cities. You bring in artists, you revitalize an old, broken down, horrible district of town, old factory buildings and warehouses. They become beautiful, interesting art spaces. And then all the yuppies want to move in and the artists can't afford to live there anymore. They move out somewhere else. And it's this continuing cycle.
That's why it's important that you have an all-inclusive economic development strategy which isn't being driven by one particular cluster. You need to have a diversified economy so that you're able to appeal to a broad spectrum and not just simply focus on one thing, because if you do, at some point, that one area of activity, everybody else will copy somewhere down the line, and suddenly you will become less popular, and gradually you will have difficulties competing effectively because you will be seen as old hat. It's a bit like the Western European cities that people were going to as the European tour. Those cities have changed dramatically. They are no longer the sort of London, Paris, Rome out. You have Prague as the number one short break destination in Europe today. Budapest is one of the most popular destinations in Europe today. Those were closed 20 years ago. So that's why when we talk about evolution of evolve or die, there are so many new cities coming on stream in both China and India. There are growing marketplaces, both producing and receiving, in terms of China and India. And we need to respond to this global economy. And the way in which the United States has been geared in terms of its cities is not the way we need to focus. And we need to, if you like, restructure the way in which we go about positioning our cities in this global economy.
Eddie Friel is president and CEO of EFA Tourism and City Marketing, and Clark Hulse is executive director of Creative Santa Fe. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for
having us. My pleasure. Thank you.